This is The Meaning of Green, Season 3. I'm Vivian Thompson. In Season 1 of The Meaning of Green, my guests and I examined how we've managed to solve, or not to solve, major environmental problems like acid rain and leaded gasoline. And we applied the policy lessons we had learned to climate change. Season 2 investigated the links between power, freedom, and the environment, and whether those links shed light on the coronavirus's emergence and spread. Season 3's overarching theme is place and the environment. We'll travel to different locations in the U.S. and around the world, characterize their environmental issues and possible remedies, and explore connections with other places. The Meaning of Green is independently produced in Cedar Closet Studios in Silver Spring, Maryland, and has no sponsor. No outside entity influences the content of this podcast. Before I started The Meaning of Green, I was for 20 years a professor of environmental policy at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Outside of academia, I've been an environmental policy official in Virginia and at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. My 3 published books are about garbage transport, climate change policy in the U.S., Brazil, and Germany, and about who wields power and how when we regulate air pollution. You can find out more about The Meaning of Green and find links for all podcast episodes at the podcast's website, meaningofgreen.com. This episode continues the story introduced in Part 1 of Elephants Grow Grasslands, Cows Grow Trees. We'll look at ideas about how to accommodate people and elephants and other wildlife in the same landscapes through community-based conservation. And we'll learn about the origins of the title of these 2 episodes. In Part 1, we came to appreciate elephants' complicated social behaviors and extraordinary communication skills. Matriarchs lead their herds, and their family bonds are incredibly strong. Once you understand even a bit about elephants, you feel humility and wonder. It's painful to learn of the steep decline in elephant numbers across Africa, driven by elephants killed for their ivory. But Kenya has increased its elephant numbers. Kenya's elephant population has doubled in the last 30 years. A variety of measures has helped protect Kenya's elephants from poachers, including patrols, ivory burns, stiff criminal penalties, aerial reconnaissance, sophisticated radio and cyber tracking capabilities, vigorous prosecution, and integrating local people into the ecotourism trade. You might be wondering, how has the pandemic affected elephant poaching in Africa? Reliable data are hard to come by. Some experts believe illegal poaching for the ivory trade may have decreased, while poaching for meat may have increased. Kenya does have pandemic-related poaching data. The Kenya Wildlife Service reported that in 2020, for the first time in 20 years, no rhinos were poached. And in 2020, only 11 elephants were poached in Kenya, the lowest annual number reported since the Wildlife Service was founded in 1990. But poaching is not the only threat to Africa's wildlife. As human populations have risen in Africa, people and wildlife of all kinds have competed more intensely for food, land, and water. In the process, wildlife habitat has become even more fragmented, making it more difficult for the animals to move around freely without encountering humans. Elephants can invade farms, raid crops, and even kill people, and local people may retaliate. Dr. Cynthia Moss, who was introduced in Part 1, has been studying elephants in Amboseli National Park in Kenya for almost 50 years. Dr. Moss points to what she believes is the main short-term threat facing Amboseli's elephants. This clip is from a 2021 YouTube piece called Elephant Scientist that was published by Kenyan historian.
Well, the main major threat for elephants today in Kenya is not poaching. Kenya's really done a very good job of stopping the poaching for ivory, you know, for the tusks. But the major threat for elephants is habitat loss. And that is that all these areas that elephants have used are being transferred to other kinds of to agriculture, to quarries, to, you know, to avocado farms and such and such. So that's really the major thing. If we lose those areas, the corridors and dispersal areas, we'll lose the populations of elephants.
Dr. Moss and her colleagues have projected what might happen to Amboseli's elephants under various scenarios involving habitat loss and climate change. Based on that work, they believe habitat conversion and human population growth pose the most significant immediate threats to Amboseli's elephants. They say it's impossible to exaggerate how important local communities will be in determining the fate of Amboseli's elephants. Dr. Winnie Kiru, who was introduced in Part 1, elaborates on the land use disruptions that threaten elephants' survival. Dr. Kiru is founder of Conservation Kenya, an environmental education and advocacy group, and director of government relations for the Elephant Protection Initiative. This clip is from an August 2021 YouTube piece by CGTN Africa.
So while subsistence agriculture continues to be dangerous for elephants, because indeed subsistence farmers will constantly fight off the elephants, but then they coexist one way or other. But commercial agriculture, no chance. The people that are investing in commercial agriculture are wealthy. They can put up electric fences. They can abstract water from the water table. They completely change the landscape. It becomes impossible for elephants to coexist.
Those commercial farms are also making life difficult for native peoples. I'll circle back to that point in a moment. First, it's important to understand that in Kenya, there's been a lot of thought about how people and wildlife can coexist in a post-colonial country. Some of those debates recall the question about how to preserve biodiversity in Ukraine's Carpathian Mountains, an issue that was central in a recent Meaning of Green episode, Gems of Ukraine. In Gems of Ukraine, I talked about the concept of community-based conservation. This means empowering local citizens to benefit directly from wildlife and thus motivating them to conserve wildlife that they might otherwise not want to protect. The idea is to find ways of preserving native species while also helping people flourish. Parks provide uncontested spaces for wildlife, and Kenya has devoted about 7.5% of its land area to parks. But advocates of community-based conservation in Kenya believe the parks alone won't sustain the country's wildlife. In such settings, it's said, it's not just that people and wildlife can live in harmony, rather, parks that exclude people can work to the detriment of wildlife preservation. This claim might seem counterintuitive, but it becomes more understandable when you consider the lingering effects of colonialism in Kenya, native peoples' ways of life, and the ecology of elephants. British colonialism is an important undercurrent in wildlife preservation debates in Kenya. When the British were the colonial power in charge from 1895 to 1963, they claimed ownership of all wildlife, and they expropriated native peoples' lands without compensation to establish wildlife reserves and white settlements. Wildlife were killed to protect European settlers' crops and for sport. An especially egregious hunt was organized in 1909 by former U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt, who undertook a safari that lasted close to a year and killed enormous numbers of animals. During the colonial era, parks creation became associated with oppression, racism, state control, and elite domination. The British government made enemies of displaced peoples and fostered the strong sense that native Africans were less important than elephants and other wildlife. Dr. John Wythaka, a former chair of the Kenya Wildlife Service Board of Trustees and a leading conservationist, wrote in 2012 that the legacy of colonial rule in Kenya was the alienation of people from wildlife and other resources they had traditionally relied on. Advocates of community-based conservation in Kenya aim to restore landscapes that people and wildlife can share. A longtime proponent of community-based conservation in Kenya is Dr. David Western, a scientist, book author, winner of awards, and founder of the African Conservation Center. Dr. Western has also led Kenya's Wildlife Service. Since the 1960s, Dr. Western has worked extensively with the Maasai people, nomadic pastoralists who traditionally move seasonally with their herds. His early research included taking care of two cows according to Maasai practices, a discipline that revealed just how much the Maasai know about ecology. The justification for including native peoples like the Maasai in the solution to wildlife declines rests on ethical, practical, and ecological rationales. A concern for environmental justice drives Dr. Western and fellow Kenyan conservationists to seek solutions that raise up Kenya's native people. From a practical perspective, as Dr. Cynthia Moss has pointed out, local people's help is needed to preserve Kenya's biodiversity. Much of Kenya's wildlife lives or migrates outside the country's parks. But the deeply embedded resentments make it hard to build trust. Dr. Western's Maasai friends once said, "Wild animals are government cattle. We're told to look after them for the tourists, and even though we have, the government wants our land, too. If we kill their animals because they kill our livestock or eat our grass, we'll be arrested." Recruiting local people to become allies in wildlife management also has an ecological basis. Dr. Western and Dr. John Waithaka saw that when cattle and elephants overlap, elephants thin the trees, letting grass grow, and cattle eat grass, which lets trees grow. The Maasai put it this way: cows grow trees, elephants grow grasslands. Where elephant herds are dense, for example in parks to which they flee to escape poachers, there are few trees and lots of grass. When elephants are missing from the landscape, trees and brush take over, making thickets that cattle find it difficult to penetrate and where they have more difficulty finding grass. Too few elephants and too many elephants can both be bad for biodiversity. Dr. Western observed that areas in which elephants and cattle overlapped showed high biodiversity. This implies that biodiversity and maintenance of human livelihoods can converge if responsibilities and rights are devolved to local users whose rich history of living alongside wildlife is recognized and supported. Recall Dr. Winnie Kiru's point from Part 1 that indigenous ecological knowledge can be intricate and deep, even if it's not published in scientific journals.
And for us to appreciate that African people have long historical ties with wildlife, and they see seasons change, and they see the way wildlife behaves, and they know a lot. And every time you go into a community and you want to respect the wildlife that's around them, it is a real omission not to engage them, to start to know what they know and what changes they are observing, because they already have more information and you can never find in a book.
Dr. Kiru's NGO, Conservation Kenya, brings young girls from nearby areas to stay for a week in Amboseli National Park.
We really think of ourselves as promoting people-centered conservation. When we conceptualized it, we thought we were going to teach the girls stuff, but just from the nature walks, you know, going out with them to the bush, we realize how aware they are of the environment within which they live. That when you go out walking with them, they show you that, oh, you know, there must have been giraffe walking here last night and zebra. And then they show you, you know, this is a snake skin and this snake must be different from the other. And they find wasp nests just because they are so close to nature.
Kenya has adopted various systems for including local people in wildlife preservation. Such systems include sharing tourism proceeds, hiring local people as guards, or integrating local people directly into tourism enterprises. In Kenya, community-based conservation programs include group and community wildlife conservancies. Conservancies are areas of land owned communally or privately that are managed for conservation and other compatible land uses. Those conservancies cover about one-tenth of the country's surface area and account for an estimated 40% of all of Kenya's wildlife. The members of those conservancies earn income from leasing their land for wildlife conservation and from ecotourism. In a 2019 talk given at the African Conservation Center, Dr. Western spoke about conservancies and related points.
Beginning with the first iteration of Kenya Wildlife Service and the second, what has been most important have been what we now call the conservancies. And John has already mentioned that they grew from just a tiny handful in the early 90s to over 150 today all over the country, protecting 11% of the area and intimately engaged with, for, and on behalf of the communities. That's been a success. And they operated informally, experimentally, for a good 15-year period. And I want to point back to that period of experimentation. There was no regulation. Every single community, with its partners, tried different things to see what worked. And we had a whole flowering of different ideologies and approaches and so on. But here's another point that hasn't been made public very widely, and something which we did for the policy several years ago. We looked at the fate of wildlife in those new conservancies compared with the national parks, and found that our national parks, like wildlife throughout the country, was in sharp decline. Inside most of the conservancies, wildlife, because of the protection of the rangers, community scouts, was now beginning to increase. And I'll just mention Amboseli. By the end of the poaching period in 1977, in Amboseli, when the communities began to get remuneration from the national park, they began to employ their own scouts. They began to be the eyes and ears. Amboseli was the only area anywhere in Kenya, 1977, the height of the poaching crisis, where the elephant population turned around and began to increase because it was under the custodianship of the local people. Finally, elephants and rhinos make a resounding recovery. And I do want to stress this because throughout this recent elephant crisis beginning in 2008, Kenya has lashed itself saying we're losing elephants. We haven't. We've been gaining elephants. From 1989, today, our elephants have increased from 19,000 to something like 38,000. That is a singular success. But I'm going to counterpoise that against an almighty failure about why the rest of our wildlife is going down while elephants are going up. The wildlife populations, with the exception of elephants and rhinos recently, have declined 60%. And work which I did shortly afterwards showed that even in our national parks, our wildlife has declined to the same extent. Why? Because the migrations moving out of parks are affected by population pressures, by agriculture, and all the other things that are taking down wildlife outside. So what we've ignored over the last 10 years, despite all our successes, is one particular phenomenon. Most of our wildlife exists in the rangelands. The rangelands are in crisis exactly the same as wildlife. Because as the human population is built up, there are too few livestock for people to subsist as they did in subsistence. They're beginning to sell land, subdivide land. They're beginning to lose the quality of their livestock. We've ignored the very important fact that the very pastoral people who are the custodians of wildlife are now suffering for exactly the same reasons of wildlife. Population growth, subdivision, agricultural expansion, and more particularly, the lack of valuation for wildlife relative to livestock.
The income conservancies generate through conservation practices and ecotourism supports community services like schools and healthcare. Research indicates that the conservancies have helped foster wildlife protection. But Kenya's conservancies face challenges, such as claims of elite favoritism and exclusion of women from decision-making processes. And then there's commercial farming. This clip is from the same 2021 CGTN Africa story that featured Dr. Kiru.
Samuel Kanki is a native of Amboseli and hails from Kenya's Maasai tribe. His people have a history of living in harmony with wildlife. He says changes in the way of life here is affecting conservation of key animal species like elephants. He is currently fighting off people investing in commercial agriculture like planting avocados.
Those are migratory routes for wildlife, and we know these animals bring tourists whom we sell our merchandise to. Our youth also get jobs in hotels, and some get employed in conservancies as rangers. So there are many ways we benefit from these migratory corridors.
The move to incorporate more community-based conservation into Kenyan biodiversity management brings us around to Nobel laureate Dr. Eleanor Ostrom. Dr. Ostrom died in 2012, just 3 years after she became the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in economics. Dr. Ostrom studied what she called social ecological systems around the world, including the Maasai in Kenya. She demonstrated that communities of fishermen, farmers, or herders could themselves devise strategies and shared rules that would sustain natural resources. Dr. Ostrom explains her findings in this undated YouTube video of a presentation made in Sweden. That presentation is called Sustainable Development and the Tragedy of the Commons.
I think it's very important for all of us to recognize that we're in dire times. And part of the dire times are that there are many more humans on Earth and that we are making a much greater impact on the Earth than our predecessors. One of the important ways of thinking about this is something that Garrett Hardin wrote in 1968 on the tragedy of the commons. And Hardin's analysis was that people were, his analogy was a pasture. And he imagined a group of pastoralists harvesting, and the more cows you put on the meadow, the more you got out, and the more you put on, the more you got out. But if we all put on too many cows, we ruin the meadow. And it was a powerful allegory and had some truth for some of the systems that humans have open access to. But many, many ways of organizing institutions enable people to use the commons together and to use it in a renewable way over time.
Then Dr. Ostrom goes over some of the economic theory behind Hardin's classic essay. And she says, well, sometimes people do overuse resources.
You use it up and it may collapse and disappear. And this has happened. So in terms of ocean fisheries, we have lost a number of species in the oceans because there have been people whose payoff was primarily private profit. And they've gone in and harvested. Sometimes we call them roving bandits because they can harvest here and then they just roam on to move someplace else. But there are many people who are not able just to roam and steal. They have a time and place that is theirs. And it isn't the government's, it is theirs. Many coastal fisheries, many lakes all over the world have been sustained by a community that organizes, but then they have to be able to create rules and enforce them. They have to determine who is a member, who can access when, and the number of incredibly complex rule systems we've discovered around the world is reassuring. You find that the people who are involved argue about it, talk about it, discuss it, found ways of adjusting their rules so they're adaptable over time to make their system resilient. They've got to be adaptable over time. And they grow trust in one another. And so in many cases where people had evolved all sorts of fascinating complexity to deal with their complexity, the presumption was, and, you know, they weren't written down. So colonial powers, for example, came in Eastern Africa and said, oh, well, they're overusing the Maasai. They kicked them off of their land and nationalized it. And then they didn't understand it, so they were over-harvesting.
Here she refers to research she did in Kenya with Dr. Esther Mwangi. They found that land degradation resulted from the system of controlled rangeland access and privatization imposed on the Maasai starting in the early 1900s. Dr. Mwangi and Dr. Ostrom contended that the Maasai's traditional ways of organizing and moving their herds as the weather changed allowed grasslands to rest and recuperate. They argued for decentralizing control of Maasai lands to take advantage of the Maasai's ecological knowledge.
If we're going to actually protect biodiversity and not have just simple systems, but complex systems where there are many species interacting, we have to have local knowledge that's rich about those ecologies. So we've got to have institutions that match the complexity of the systems that are involved. So my motto will be build enough diversity to cope with the diversity of the world and allow multi-tier systems at multiple scales so that you don't try to have a uniform top-down panacea that's predicted to cure everything and instead of curing it, kills it.
Dr. Ostrom is a prominent critic of the idea advanced by Garrett Hardin and others, it should be noted, that people will invariably destroy shared resources if they're not restrained by an external authority. But let's be very clear. Dr. Ostrom did not say, let's just get rid of government and privatize. Rather, Dr. Ostrom showed that in some circumstances, people in a particular place have developed rules and ways of living within their communities that foster ecosystem resilience. Among the factors that allow communities to self-organize in this manner are not having too many members and using a resource that is stationary and of moderate size. There are many situations, such as air pollution and river systems, that don't lend themselves to effective community self-regulation. Dr. Ostrom resisted what she called the panacea trap, saying that government, markets, and community-based conservation can all work in some situations, but there's no one solution that will work everywhere. And Dr. Ostrom might not be surprised to hear that the pandemic has produced some unexpected conservation outcomes in Kenya. Dr. Paula Kahumbu, CEO of the Kenyan NGO Wildlife Direct, commented in 2021 that while lower tourism revenues have threatened the livelihoods of many Kenyans, the drop in travel has had some unexpected positive impacts. This YouTube video was posted by Wildlife Direct.
Despite all the hardships and the difficulties and the challenges that we're facing around coronavirus, there are some things that have emerged that remind us of how important conservation is. First, animals like Najil and Fatu, the northern white rhinos, they're thriving. Many of the wildlife in Masai Mara, the big cats, they're thriving. The vegetation is doing extremely well because there isn't that much traffic. So what we're seeing is an interesting kind of ecological recovery because of the reduced numbers of visitors driving around these landscapes. Here, I think I was the proudest because despite coronavirus, with most of the international scientists returned back to their countries of origin, the Kenyan scientists have continued the work. The pandemic has reminded us of how important it is to build our local capacity, to strengthen our ability to do this high-end research ourselves.
Before we leave Dr. Kahumbu, let's recall what she said in a 2017 Forbes interview that's posted on YouTube.
Anybody who buys ivory, uses ivory, or has ivory is in some way helping the slaughter of elephants. It's part of the problem. So just last week, the US government crushed a ton of ivory in a central park. And that was a global message, very similar to what Kenya has done. I want Americans to know that they shouldn't be buying ivory or owning ivory or keeping ivory.
I hesitated for a long time before putting these two episodes together because I worry about just scratching the surface of a very complicated story. But what seems clear is that Kenya's conservation challenges are inseparable from colonialism's multiple sustained racist injustices to Native Africans. I find convincing the Kenyan experts who say their parks need to be supplemented with landscapes that people and wildlife can share with a minimum of conflict. Navigating that course isn't easy, especially given Kenya's steep population increase, the country's ethnic divisions, and growth in commercial agriculture. In part one of this two-part episode, I talked about my trip to the Central African country of Cameroon when I saw elephants and giraffes in the wild. On that trip, I also listened to a lot of infectious African music, some traditional, some more modern. Music builds bridges between cultures and peoples. So I encourage you to find some music by Kenyan musicians and listen to it. The musical underlay you heard earlier in this episode is from a 2014 concert by Kenyan musician Winyo and his fellow musicians that was sponsored by the U.S. Library of Congress. Winyo's name is spelled W-I-N-Y-O. Another leading Kenyan singer is Susanna Owiyo. That's spelled S-U-Z-A-N-N-A-O-W-I-Y-O. The final snatch of music today is from Ms. Owiyo's recording of Wamiel, Let's Dance, which is available on YouTube. I'm Vivian Thompson. Thank you for listening to The Meaning of Green, Season 3.